Michael, gjörðu svo vel.
Hi, my name is Michael Manning Earle, and I'm a female alcoholic. And I'm just overwhelmed at being in Iceland. I just hope I don't start crying before I get into my talk because it's very emotional for me. And I'm really, really nervous. I think if nobody ever heard of me, I wouldn't be so nervous. But every time when I got here, everybody already knew my story. They were quoting stuff in my story. And so it's made me really, really nervous. And it made me think just a little while ago, I was sitting there thinking about this woman that I was speaking with at a convention, and it was her very first AA talk at a convention of this size, and she was so nervous. And she came up to me, and she was telling me how nervous she was. This was her very first talk at a convention, and she asked me if I had any advice for her. So I gave her the advice that was given to me at my first AA convention. I was told to always remember the two P's, pee and pray before you talk. So I went up to this woman just before she was to get up and talk, and I whispered in her ear, I said, did you pee and pray? She said, oh, my God, I even pooped. And that's how nervous I am this morning. So anyway, thank you. Thank you for allowing me to be here. I get to do this a lot, not in Iceland and not in other countries, but all over the United States and Canada. I get to share my story a lot, and I just feel like it's a gift from God. I do not feel like this is my form of service. This is not my form of service. I've never read anywhere in the big book anything about being a speaker. The only thing I've read in the big book is about one-to-one with another drunk, getting out of yourself and carrying this message one-to-one to another drunk. And that's my form of service. I'm very fortunate that I'm married to the man I married because he is also in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's passionate about AA. He doesn't like to speak, though. I don't know if you've noticed him walking around and picking up everybody else's sobriety station. He's been picking up cups, straightening out chairs, cleaning up after people. That's the kind of service he likes to do. And I'm very proud of him for that. You know, I'm very proud of him. He's really a hands-on man, and we have an AA home. And our home represents the chapter in the big book, Working with Others. And when I first read that chapter 21 years ago when I came into this program, I looked at that chapter and it didn't make sense to me because everyone that was coming into AA were coming out of treatment centers. And they were 30 days sober and they were handed to us on a silver platter. And so I didn't identify with that chapter. But now I don't know if it's happening out here, but in the United States, we're losing our treatment centers because alcoholics are so therapeutic slick. All they do is they go into a treatment center, come out, get drunk. Go into a treatment center, get out, get drunk. Go into a treatment center, get out, get drunk. And so we're losing our treatment centers. You know, insurance companies and everyone's getting sick of paying for drunks getting sober when they're not staying sober. And so we're losing our treatment centers. And so what we're getting to experience is having to work one-to-one with alcoholics, as it says in Chapter 7. We've had them vomiting in cars. We detox them in our homes. This one lady we took into our home had a grand mal seizure 3 days after she had her last drink. I mean, it's really, really a serious thing. It's a dangerous thing. I mean, we really do need hospital treatment. I'm so sorry that we're losing these treatment centers because a lot of alcoholics need to be medically detoxed. But I do love what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. So we detox anybody in our home, but we don't let just anybody in our home to live. We always take newcomers into our home. We have 1 to 6 newcomers living with us on a, you know, there's always 1 to 6. Right now we're down to 2, and that's manageable. It's really hard having 6 newcomers living in your house. But we, you know, the book says we use discretion. And so we'll detox anybody in our house, but we use discretion when it comes to letting somebody live with us. And we watch people in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous for a while. And if we see them coming to meetings and not drinking and really trying, but sleeping in a car and they don't have a job, we will take them into our homes. And what I do is I get them through their steps. And what Ted does is he teaches them how to live. You know, he gets them to a DUI school to get their driver's license back. He gets them to get their high school diploma. He helps them get a job. He teaches them how to balance a checkbook. He teaches them living skills, which I never learned as a little girl. He's teaching me living skills, aren't you, honey? So we just make a perfect couple at getting some of these people on their feet, you know, and most of them get on their feet and go out and become useful members of Alcoholics Anonymous. We do have a few that go back out, and it's heartbreaking. A couple of them we just dearly love, and just because we love them so much and they love AA so much, they just keep coming back. You know, we're willing to keep taking them in, but we do use discretion, and It's just a wonderful way to live. But I feel like speaking is a gift God gave me. It's not my form of service. I think God's allowed me to speak in Alcoholics Anonymous. He's allowed me to walk through my fears. It's one of the scariest things I've ever done, is stand up at a podium and share my story. I know you all probably think that this is real easy for me, but it is not. It's very difficult. I couldn't even read how it works when I was 4 years sober. It was terrifying for me. I'd get up here and almost throw up. I just couldn't stand up in front of people. And I couldn't get on airplanes for 12 and a half years of sobriety. And I just feel like this is a gift God gave me to walk through my fears. And if I wasn't willing to walk through my fears, I would never have met my husband. I would never have met Carl. I would never have met Mickey, Thor, all of you wonderful people in Iceland. All this is a gift because I've been willing to just walk through my fears no matter how afraid I am. And I'm just thankful that you invited me to Iceland. And I'm thankful I got on that airplane because I didn't want to get on it. Oh, my God, we're going to fly over the ocean. So anyway, I met my husband. I was living in Long Beach, California, and my husband was in South Carolina and Georgia, which is on the other coast of the United States. And I was speaking at a convention. And that's where I met him. And, you know, I just fell passionately in love with him just from seeing his smile, you know, just from seeing his smile. And we had a long distance relationship. And it's really funny. God has a real sense of humor because I had just finished another sex inventory, you know, and in the sex inventory, it tells you that you ask God to mold your ideals for your future sex life. And so my sponsor had me write out what my ideals for my future sex life. And I wrote out, okay, my ideal now is, and I'm really clear on it, my ideal is love and marriage. I did not want sex out of marriage. I didn't want marriage without love. So I wrote just those simple little words, love and marriage. And shortly after that, I met my husband in Georgia, and I'm in California, so there's no chance of sex. And I learned everything I knew about him on the telephone and by letters, and that was a wonderful way to get to know somebody. He turned out to be everything that I thought he was. We got married on the beach where I met him. It was a fairy tale wedding. You know, we had six dolphins out in the ocean and a rainbow came out. It was just a fairy tale wedding. And this is really corny. I don't even know if you guys are familiar with Shakespeare, but this is really corny that we actually live on a street called Sir Lancelot in a subdivision called Camelot. And I'm embarrassed to share that with people, you know, but it's the truth. And he's been there just waiting for me to come. But anyway, so I went back to California and I packed up my stuff and I moved to Georgia. And I wish I could tell you that I lived happily ever after. That wasn't the case. Something set in, something called reality. And I'm telling you, it was a culture shock. It was an absolute culture shock. I'm used to Los Angeles. You know, it's a big city. If I moved to Atlanta, it might have been different. But no, I moved to a little suburb right on the border of South Carolina. And anything I know about a deer is Bambi. Do you have deers out here? No deers out here? Okay, well, anyway, we have deers, and I just love them, you know, and there's a Walt Disney movie out called Bambi, and it's about deers, and I just would look at Bambi, and I just loved Bambi, and I moved to Georgia, and everybody shoots Bambi. There were dead deer everywhere. If something moved, somebody shot it, you know, and... You know, I just wasn't used to that. And I was sitting there looking at this cute little squirrel. Do you guys have squirrels out here? No squirrels, huh? I was looking at this cute little squirrel. It's a little fuzzy thing with this big old tail about this big. And it's crawling up a tree in my yard. It's got this big nut in its mouth. And I'm just thinking how cute that is. And the next door neighbor shot the squirrel. And that squirrel was my squirrel because it was in my tree. And I was so upset I told my husband, I said, well, at least in Los Angeles, we don't shoot the animals. And he said, no, you just shoot each other. And that was a hunk of truth. But anyway, the hardest thing that I went through at that time was I also went into menopause. Do you guys have menopause out here? How many of you know what menopause is? Oh, look at all the men. They live with menopausal women, right? Well, that's for you that don't know, menopause is going through the change of life for a woman. And it's very dramatic. your body starts doing all kinds of weird things on you, and you don't know what's going on. I felt like I was having a nervous breakdown. I didn't know I was in menopause, and it was just, I sunk into a very, very deep depression, and I also started having some physical ailments, and I have a lot of shame behind this. In the last 6 years, I've had 8 surgeries. And I have shame behind that because I used to judge my mother. And I have found for me, being judgmental is very dangerous because my experience is if I judge you, I end up walking in your shoes, experience your experience to get over the judgment. And that's happened to me many times in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I pray on a daily basis for God to help me with judgmentalness because I'm sick of walking in your shoes. You know, it's been a powerful lesson for me. But I used to judge my mom. You know, I used to think that she was a hypochondriac, that she imagined all these illnesses, that she imagined them because she wanted to take pills and she wanted to drink. And so I was very judgmental of her. And now today I'm walking in her shoes. I'm having some of the same problems. You know, some of this stuff is passed on in your genes. And I'm having some of the same problems and some of the same complications that my mom had. And I'm getting to experience some of the pain my mom experienced. Good thing about that is I've got a new love and a new respect for my mom. But, you know, it's a heavy price to pay. And it's been very difficult, and I feel very shameful about it. And I just have a lot of shame about having all these surgeries. I think, God, do people think I'm a hypochondriac, that I don't work a good program? But it's just, you know, what I'm having to walk through. And it's been very challenging for me. One of my favorite sentences in the Big Book is at the very bottom of 14. This is in the English version of the Big Book. It's the bottom of 14, top of 15. It says, for if an alcoholic fails to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive those certain trials and low spots ahead. So that sentence tells me two things. First of all, it tells me if I'm not working with others, I fail to grow spiritually. I can pray, I can meditate, I can even go to church. But if I'm not working with others, I fail to grow spiritually. And then it also tells me, if I'm not working with others, I'm not going to survive those trials and low spots ahead. We are guaranteed to have trials and low spots. Some people think you just quit drinking and everything gets perfect, and that's just not the case. People still get sick. People still get old. People still die. Accidents still happen. And working with others is going to get you through these trials and low spots every time. My husband and I work with a treatment center in Georgia. It's at a military base. It's called Fort Gordon. And it's one of the last treatment centers for the military. And Ted goes there and he just gives them, you know, a introductory on Alcoholics Anonymous. And then on Wednesday nights, the fort allows this whole treatment center to come over to our house. We have a barbecue, and then we go into what we call our AA room. It's just a beautiful room. It has all kinds of pictures of all the founders of AA. I have a board off of Dr. Bob's porch that says Love and Service. I have a plant growing all around it that was a plant that had actually belonged to Bill Wilson. And I brought cuttings for Thor, so I hope he gets them around Iceland, of this plant that belonged to Bill Wilson. But anyway, it's just spiritual things happen in this room. And we go in this room and we get into the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we get them for a 4-week period. So we get four Wednesdays to work with them. So we get into the Big Book dealing with step one. First of all, the very first week I give them a history, about an hour of the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, because if God's hard for you to accept, when you hear the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's hard to deny that we have a God, and we have a loving God, and that God loved drunk so much that he gave us the 12 steps to recover. So we get into the history, then we get into step one, we get into step two, and by the time they leave, they're on their knees in a group saying the third step prayer and on their fourth step. So by the time they get to whatever state they're going to, they're ready to do their fifth step. And it's one of the last treatment centers, so because the military's sick of paying for drunks getting sober and they go back out drinking. So these soldiers come from all the different militaries, Air Force, Navy, Marines, Army, all the different militaries, and all the different states, even Alaska. So anyway, I'm going to tell you a story about one of the guys. I don't know how many months ago that we were on step two. And this guy just got in my face. I mean, this big old soldier in my room's full of soldiers. I mean, there must have been 25 soldiers there and maybe 7 or 8 alcoholics from the neighborhood, you know, from our home group. And he just gets in my face and he folds his arm like this and he says, yeah, well, if there's a God, it's going to take a burning bush to prove it to me. And I thought, well, I wish Mickey was there. He was on fire last night, wasn't he? Anyway, and I thought, well, I'm just out of burning bushes. And then I thought about this man. I asked this guy, I said, what's your name? And he said his name was Lee. And so that made me think of another man named Lee that wrote me a letter. He wrote me a letter 2 years after he had a spiritual experience. And he had a spiritual experience during one of my AA talks. And please, I'm not taking credit for this. This is between him and God. It has nothing to do with me. But anyway, I was speaking in Alabama, Gulf Shores, Alabama. And the name of this conference was Gulf Shores Jubilee. Some of them are called roundups, conventions. This was called a jubilee, a big celebration. And so on the stage in Mardi Gras, colorful neon lights, on the stage above the speaker or behind the speaker was this big neon light that said jubilee. And so the whole time I'm giving my talk, first of all, this man was at the jumping off place that you heard talked about this weekend. That's somebody who's got some sobriety under their belt, but they really haven't thrown themselves into the program, and he didn't believe in God, and he was just miserable, and he was trying to make the decision whether to commit suicide or to drink. And for some reason, he decided to go to one of the meetings at this convention, and it just happened to be my meeting. These are all these little God coincidences, if you look for it. It just happened to be my meeting, and he was the first one in the auditorium. And so he just picked any seat. And if he'd sat in any other seat in that auditorium, he would not have had the spiritual experience. He had to sit in the seat that he sat in. And the whole time I was talking, he is just looking down at the floor, not paying any attention to me because he's into self and all of his problems. And then I always close my story with how I came to terms with the God I have in my life today. And I'll close my story with that today. But it had to do with my daughter's rape. My daughter was kidnapped from an AA dance, brutally raped and almost murdered, and she was 3 years sober. And it took me a long time to process and get through that and come to terms with God. And I'll just tell you basically what the end result was of a series of spiritual experiences I had. What I learned from all this is that God is good, and good is God. And if it's not good, it's not of God. And that there is a difference between man's world and God's world. And everything in God's world is perfect, but everything in man's world is not. So anyway, I'm sharing the story about my daughter's kidnapping because it was a tragic story, it caught his attention. And so he was sitting there just listening, but still not looking up at me. And finally, as I was closing and I was saying the words, God is good and good is God, this force that he couldn't explain just started to pull his chin up. And no matter what he did, he couldn't keep his chin down. So this force is pulling his chin up, and echoing out of his ears are the words, God is good and good is God. It's just echoing in his ears. And by the time he looked up at me, my body is blocking the whole part of the sign that says Juba, and the only part of the sign he could see was Lee, which was his name, in neon lights. So it's God is good, good is God. Lee, I'm talking to you. And that was his spiritual experience. And he so doubted it, it took him 2 years to write me a letter, but things from his life changed from that point on, and that's when he came to believe. And so I'm telling this story to this man named Lee who's sitting in a chair right here next to me. And this is the honest to God truth. On this side of me is an artificial bush about this high. On the other side, and we had to move stuff around to get all the chairs in the room. So this artificial bush is shoved over a little bit. And on the other side of it is a halogen lamp. And honest to God, I'm saying the words, God is good, good is God. The halogen lamp caught on fire and a flame went up. Poof! And you should have seen this soldier come out of his chair. He was just white as a ghost, and he jumped up, and he's looking at the bush, and he's going, oh, my God, oh, my God. And I'm going, oh, my God, oh my, I didn't care about his spiritual experience. I'm afraid my house is going to burn down. I'm going, oh, my God, and we're trying to get this lamp and the bush straightened out and get the lamp out in the garage. And it's just chaos, you know. And by the time all of us came back into the room, we sat down and we settled down. It was like, oh, my God. All of us in that room had a spiritual experience because he demanded something and it came about and we all witnessed it. So it was a spiritual experience for us, all of us. And, you know, that was a day right after I had a surgery. And I can remember that morning telling my husband, I just don't have the energy to do this tonight. I just can't do this tonight. And when I suit up and show up, no matter how bad I feel, something wonderful happens, and it gets me through these situations every time. And I'm telling you, I didn't feel any pain. I didn't feel any sickness or any illness, and that lasted me for several days. And that's why I keep doing what I'm doing is, you know, it just gets, well, that's why I used to keep doing what I'm doing. Why I really keep doing what I'm doing now is really there's nothing like seeing the lights go on in somebody's eyes. I mean, there's nothing like it. It's a feeling that you must not miss. You know, they talk about it on the top of 89. saying to watch people recover, to see them help others. This is an experience you must not miss. And these are the things that I get to experience because I keep suiting up and showing up no matter how I feel. And it gets me out of myself, and God gets in there and takes care of the situation when I'm out of myself. Anyway, when I crawled through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous over 21 years ago, I had a formal ninth grade education. I didn't know how to work. I lived on welfare. I was reduced to prostitution, and I was a thief. And all of that was before I took that first drink at the age of 25. Do we have any newcomers here? We had a lot yesterday. How many people with less than a year? Oh, a lot. Great. I like to welcome the newcomers, and I like newcomers to know that the absolute highest you get in Alcoholics Anonymous is sober, of the sobriety kind, sober. It's not a speaker. This is the truth. It is not a speaker, and I'm not an authority on AA. I'm just up here sharing my personal experience, strength, and hope. And the things I say from the podium are the things that had a profound effect on my personal sobriety. Now, I like to welcome those of you who are not so new but are having difficulty with this program. I saw a sign in an AA club that always gave me a lot of hope, and that sign says, "You're not a failure unless you quit trying." And I believe that to be true. So please, whatever you do, just keep coming back. But I was told early on in this program that this program is not for spectators. This is a program of action, and those actions are the 12 steps as laid out in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Dr. Bob, one of our co-founders, said if you boil those 12 steps into two words, those two words would be love and service. And before he said that, he said, "I want to emphasize the simplicity of this program. Let's not louse it up with Freudian complexes that are interesting to the scientific mind but have little to do with our actual AA work." And I see a lot of things drifting in and out of AA today. They might not be Freudian, but they're just as useless. You know, and what they do is they just complicate this very simple program. I like to talk about Dr. Bob because I come from a line of sponsorship. I talked about it a little bit yesterday. I come from a line of sponsorship that came down from Dr. Bob, and I'm very thankful for that line of sponsorship because they paid a great deal of attention to steps 6 and 7, and a lot of people miss those steps. You know, if you know the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know that they were in a hurry to write the big book. They always did the actions of 6 and 7 at the moral inventory. The sponsor did it with the sponsoree. They discussed these character defects at great length because they really did believe that you would drink over some of your character defects, especially the glaring character defects. So they went over these character defects at great length, and the sponsor got on their knees with the sponsoree and prayed to have these defects removed. And there's only two paragraphs in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and 6 and 7. That's because Bill was just in a hurry to get the steps stretched into 12 and to get the book published. And he elaborates more of it in the 12 and 12 on step 6. And he says, "The man that repeatedly works on his other defects of character grows in the image of his creator." And he says that God will not render you white as snow without your cooperation. And then he addresses the fact that some of our other defects are harder to remove than alcoholism. When you're ready, if you're really ready, he can just get in there and expel the obsession for alcohol, because alcohol is not a natural instinct. And Bill says some of our other character defects are natural instincts that have gone amok. God gave us natural instincts to survive, and so he cannot remove a natural instinct. So Bill says sometimes we might have to just, you know, settle for patient improvement. And, you know, some of my character defects were removed right away, well, within, you know, a short period of time. And two of those that I had to give up, my sponsor had to give up right away, was stealing and prostitution. She said if I continued those two things, I was going to drink. And I have shame behind this, but the last time I prostituted, I was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 6 months sober, and I had a spiritual experience behind that. But since that day, you know, I haven't prostituted. And stealing was very hard for me. It was habit for me to steal. And I'd have to call my sponsor on a daily basis and tell her I commit not to steal today. I had to really work with my higher power on that. But those two character defects were totally removed. Totally removed. And I can't believe I was ever that person, but I was. But one defective character that I struggle with right now is an eating disorder, you know, and that had to go on my list of character defects. I've had recovery in that area of my life. You know, I've had 12 years of healthy eating and being very thin, and when I moved to Georgia, just with all the chaos and all the surgeries and medication that puts weight on you, and just, you know, and even being on pain pills that makes you not even care about your weight, which I took, you know, appropriately. You know, I've struggled with my weight again, and so that's a defect that I'm really working on again. You know, I'm having to surrender to that one more time, but I'm very thankful for that kind of sponsorship. So anyway, that's the way I sponsor. You know, I sponsor that way. When I listen to a fifth step, I always do 6, 7, and 8 at the same time. And I was working with this woman named Amy, and I learned so much from the women I sponsor. I learned a lot about me, but I learned about things in the big book come clear, you know, make more sense to me. But the one thing this woman had on her list of character defects is she had an eating disorder. She would go anywhere from compulsive overeating to anorexia to bulimia. And bulimia is where you eat and you throw it up. And that's her way of staying thin. And she was very bulimic. And she also was bulimic with exercise. You know, she would eat something, so then she'd go run 10 miles. She was very obsessive and compulsive about running. And I had to, you know, of all the people I sponsor, some of the sickest ones are that have eating disorders. They're, because they're so self-centered. The whole world revolves around their body. Even though they're alcoholic, they get sober, and the whole world revolves around their body. They don't know that there's children out there starving. There's children out there being abused. There's accidents happening. There's earthquakes in other countries. They don't have a clue about that because the world revolves around their body. It's so self-centered, and it is so sick. And I had to get very honest with her and usually I'm a very kind, loving, gentle sponsor because that's the way I was sponsored, with a lot of love. But I had to get really tough on her, and I had to really get in her face and tell her that she was critical, that you are absolutely critical, and if you don't address this now, you're going to die, you know, because that's where it was taking her in her eating disorder. And I said, your only hope is to get out of yourself and start helping other people. And so in my grandiose thinking, I thought, well, God's going to bring her a wet drink. That girl's so sick, she needs a wet drink to work with to get her out of herself, because they're really hard to deal with when they're drinking. And so I told her she had to get on her knees every day and pray for God to bring somebody into her life to help. And so she was willing to do that. So she'd get on her knees every morning, she'd pray for God to bring someone in her life to help, and then she'd get up and she'd go run her 10 miles. So, but she did that for 5 days straight, and on the fifth day, she got on her knees and she prayed, God, please bring somebody in my life for me to help. And for some reason, she was inspired to get back in bed and spend another hour in prayer and meditation. She never gave God an hour of her time. She was the kind that would say a quick prayer while she's in the shower, or maybe a quick prayer in between songs on the radio, you know, but she gave God an hour of her time. And so when it came time to run her 10 miles, which she wasn't willing to give up or moderate, it was 6:30 in the morning instead of 5:30. And so it was a little lighter outside. So instead of running her normal path up into the woods, she took a different path because it was light out. And she has this dog that she got from the Humane Society. Do you know what a Humane Society is? It's a rescue place where they rescue dogs and homeless dogs that are in bad shape. They try to rehabilitate them and find homes for them. So she's got this rescued dog that she got from this Humane Society. And this dog is just her best friend. And this dog is always by her side. And so they go running up into the woods on this different path. And all of a sudden, the dog takes off and runs deep into the woods. The dog has never left her before. She couldn't figure out what had happened to the dog. She kept screaming at her dog to come back, and it wouldn't come back. So she finally had to run out into the woods and find her dog. And by the time she got to her dog, she found her dog licking a 2-year-old baby in the face. This baby had been missing all night. It was huddled up in the pine straw. It was 40 degrees outside, which is cold. I know, I don't know if what your temperatures are, you know, the difference between Fahrenheit and all that. But anyway, it was 40 degrees out, which is cold, not quite freezing, but before freezing, very cold. And the baby only had on a T-shirt, no shoes, no diaper. It had been missing all night, and it was huddled up in the pine straw. And so the dog's looking the baby in the face. And by the time Amy got to the baby lifts up her arms to her. And that was Amy's spiritual experience. All of a sudden, God was using her to help somebody else. And so she picks up this baby, and she walks a mile to a house. And by the time she got to this house, they were so excited because they knew the baby was missing. It was all over the news. Everybody knew about it except for Amy. She's too self-centered to watch the news. They had bloodhounds out all night looking for this baby, but this baby had wandered at 2 miles beyond. They marked off a distance they thought a 2-year-old could wander, and this baby went 2 miles further than that. And so it was a really big deal. All the newspapers showed up. They put her in the newspaper. They put her in Runner's Magazine. They tried to get her on talk shows. I mean, it was a real big deal, and it was a real boost for the Humane Society because, you know, the Humane Society was struggling, and all of a sudden in the newspaper it says, rescued dog, rescued child. So it was a boost for the Humane Society. Amy had her spiritual experience. She got to feel the feeling of being used by God. She never had that feeling before, and that's what turned her around to get active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and to get active working with others. But the lesson I learned from that is, I told you my very favorite sentence. It says, for if an alcoholic fails to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through help, work, and sacrifice for others, it doesn't say other alcoholics. It says others. So that means in the program or out of the program. And that's all part of the 12th step, applying these principles in all our affairs. So anyway, in the big book, under Doctor's Opinion, it tells me that many types of alcoholics do not respond to the ordinary psychological approach. So I'm here today to tell you that I'm one of those alcoholics. In fact, so is my mom. We both tried to recover from this disease through the psychiatric effort. Different times, but we went to the same psychiatrist. Of course, the result was nil. But the good news is that today, that very same psychiatrist is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My mom and I both tried to recover from this disease through the religious effort, different times in different congregations, but the result was the same. And believe it or not, today, that very same minister that counseled me is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I used to joke around and say, I think we drove these two men to drink. But the truth is, and this is the truth, my mom slept with the psychiatrist and I slept with the minister. And that is my only qualification for being the Sunday morning spiritual speaker. In the United States, this Sunday morning spot is considered the spiritual spot. And that's why I get this all the time, just because I slept with this minister. I don't know. Anyway, one thing I do know for sure is that psychiatrists, that minister, and myself are perfect examples that AA works when other things fail. A little bit about my background. First of all, I'm Irish, German, and Cherokee, which is Indian, American Indian, and I'm illegitimate. And being born out of wedlock today is just not a big deal, but when I was a little girl growing up, it was. And my childhood is pretty appalling. So in my mom's defense, I want to tell you a little bit about her childhood, because as bad as mine was, my mom's was worse. And this program gave me the ability to have a very loving relationship with my mom, even though she couldn't quit drinking. And I lost my mom 8 years ago. She died of lung cancer. And I had the opportunity to practice love and service at home. We had hospice come in. My sister and I took her home. We had hospice come in. And my mom died at home, and she actually got to die with a little bit of dignity. I had the ability to get in bed with my mom, hold her all night, and just love her unconditionally. And I had to watch this woman drink on top of morphine up until the day she could no longer swallow. And it's probably one of the hardest things I've ever done. But one thing I learned from this whole experience is that my whole life growing up, I was so focused on the things I hated about my mom, the things I didn't want to be like, that I missed all of her wonderful qualities. My mom had a lot of wonderful qualities, and I really miss her a lot today. But my mom came from an alcoholic background, and when she was 13, her mother was murdered in a drunken brawl. A drunk slit my grandmother's throat. So that left my mom out on the streets at the age of 13, trying to raise herself. At the age of 14, she had her first baby, which she gave up for adoption. And then she had me. And she did everything in her power to keep me. She later met this man, got married, had three boys, gave me three brothers. We all moved to California. That marriage soon ended in divorce, and my stepfather moved back to Colorado. So that left my mom out in California trying to raise four little kids, and we were raised on welfare. We were raised in extreme, extreme poverty, always having lights, gas, telephones turned off, always being evicted, even sleeping in cars. And I had to deal with my mom's alcoholism. I had to deal with her prostitution, and I had to deal with her suicide attempts. When I was 12, my mom got pregnant again. And this time she sent my three brothers to live with their real dad in Colorado. Now, my three brothers were my very best friends. When you're sleeping in cars and you're always being evicted, you don't have an opportunity to make friends. So my brothers were my friends. So I feel like at the age of 12, I already had all these feelings that I later brought with me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And those feelings were of low self-worth, low self-esteem, not equal to, and just not good enough. And that was a direct result of all that poverty. That drunken psychiatrist told me that I had issues of abandonment. You know, I never knew my real dad. My stepdad went away. My brothers went away. My mom's always trying to kill herself. And because of some other childhood experiences, I would say I'm a fear-based person. I have always been afraid of people, places, and things. And the two very important things I learned when I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is, first of all, I learned that feelings are not facts. And all those things I used to think about myself were not the truth. And best of all, I learned how to walk through fear. And I learned that every time I walk through fear, I'm actually exercising faith. And this last 12 years, I walked through one of my biggest fears, and it's getting on airplanes. It took me 12 and a half years to finally get on an airplane. 12 and a half years of sobriety to finally get on an airplane. And I found out that I'm not even afraid of flying. I'm afraid of crashing. My sponsor told me that I'd better be clear on what my fear was when I was asking God to remove it. But I hear a lot of things in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that are not necessarily in the big book. And they can confuse a newcomer. And the one thing I used to hear all the time is that you could not have fear and faith at the same time. That if you had fear, you didn't have any faith. And so I couldn't figure out what I was doing wrong in my program because I'd worked these steps as hard as I could work these steps. I've had spiritual experiences, but I still had all this fear. And I finally went over to this man who used to say that statement all the time, and I asked him, I said, what am I doing wrong in my program? Why do I still have all this fear? And he told me in the most arrogant, know-it-all way, he said, well, it sounds to me like you haven't taken a thorough third step. Today I know the third step's only a decision. That's all the third step is. And to follow up on that decision is I have to take those actions of 4 through 9. That's actually how you turn your will and your life over to the care of God. Did you know that was a process? Have you ever thought, how do you turn your will and your life over to the care of God? How do you do it? You pick up the pen and you start writing your 4-step. 4 through 9 is a process of turning your will and your life over to the care of God. And to continue doing that, you live in 10, 11, and 12. When you're doing that, you're in God's will. So anyway, finally I went up to one of these old timers in the Long Beach area that really was beneficial in my sobriety, and I was crying on his shoulder about this fear and faith thing, and he said, Michael, nowhere in the big book does it tell you you cannot have fear and faith at the same time. And he took me to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he took me to page 68 under the fear inventory, and he pointed out a sentence to me, and this sentence says, all men of faith have courage. All men of faith have courage. And then he pointed out to me, you don't need courage unless you're afraid. And then he took me down to the bottom of that paragraph where it gives you the little fear prayer. And it says, God, remove my fear and direct my attention to what you'd have me be. And I'm always directed to work with another program, whether they're in the program or out of the program. If I can get out of me and I can think about you, God can get in there and take care of the fear. That's how I get on airplanes when my husband's not with me. I look for little old ladies I can help with their bags. They don't want the help sometimes. It scares them. Give me that bag. I'm trying to help you. But that's what I do at an airport when I'm terrified. And on the airplane when we're in turbulence, really bad turbulence, I sit there. I always have pen and paper with me. You can't get up on the airplane and run around down the aisle going, let me help you, let me help you. So I get out pen and paper, and I just start writing the downs of names of people that I know are suffering and having problems or dealing with their sobriety or health issues or surgeries, and I start writing their names down and praying for them. And while I'm doing that, I'm not thinking about the turbulence that I'm in. You know, so God just takes care of the fear thing. And every time I land safely, boy, I have all this faith. You know, it's just amazing. I got all this faith. So walking through fear is exercising faith. Anyway, when I was 13, my mom did have this baby, and I had to learn how to be a mom, and I didn't even know how to be a kid. My mom's alcoholism took her out of the home. She was never, ever around. And I had full responsibility of this little baby. This little baby is sleeping in a dresser drawer. I had to potty train her, bottle break her. I'm failing in school because I can't get to school because of this responsibility. Now, after doing my inventory, I found out the truth was I hated school anyway. When I went to school, I was either an object of pity around my peers, or I was teased about the way I dressed and teased about my hair. And so specifically, to get out of my home life, at the age of 15, I got married. And the man I married was 18. He lived in the neighborhood. He came from a similar background. And I have such a colorful past, I like to brag about this. I want everyone here to know when I got married at the age of 15, I was not pregnant. At the age of 15, I had high morals and high values. I truly did. I used to watch these two TV shows, and I don't think you've heard of them out here in Iceland. And if you did, if they were out here, you wouldn't remember them because you're too young. But it was Donna Reed and Father Knows Best. Have any of you seen those programs? Never heard of them? Well, they're family shows. You know, it's about this idealistic, not real family life. You know, these two families. And so, but because of these shows, I had these high morals and high values. My whole life growing up, all I knew is when I grew up, I didn't want to be an alcoholic like my mom, and I didn't want to prostitute like my mom. So when I got married at the age of 15, I had the wild idea that I was Miss Donna Reed marrying Mr. Father Knows Best. And unfortunately, it didn't turn out that way, and I believe the man I married was an alcoholic. One indication, his name was Johnny Walker. Do you guys have Johnny Walker out here? Oh, I didn't know that. I didn't think you guys would get that one. Yeah, his name was Johnny Walker. But I want to share a story with you about that sister of mine, the one that slept in the dresser drawer. Because when I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I used to blame my alcoholism on my mom's alcoholism. I blamed the way I turned out on the way I was raised. And after I got sober in this program, I took a good look at that sister of mine because she came from the very same background. In fact, I would say her childhood was worse than mine because my mom's disease of alcoholism had progressed. And my sister was literally forced to move out of the house at the age of 16. So she quit school and she moved out. But what she did is she took that high school equivalency test, and she had to take it 3 times until she finally passed it. With this test under her belt, under special youth program, at the age of 16, she went to work for the city of Long Beach. At the age of 26, she retired from the city of Long Beach. She took her 10 years retirement pay. She bought her own business. She later married the head traffic engineer for the city of Long Beach. And 8 or 9 years ago, at the age of 30, my sister was awarded Woman Entrepreneur of the Year. Now, even today, sometimes I still don't get it. You know, same mom, same background, but different reactions. And the difference is, my sister is not an alcoholic. My sister is not bodily and mentally different from her fellows. My sister reacts to life situations differently than I do. So today I get to accept responsibility, and I can no longer blame those people, places, and things. Yes, I am an alcoholic, and I do have a disease, but today I have a solution. And for me, part of my solution is being accountable for my actions, my past actions and my present actions. So anyway, at the age of 15, I got married. At the age of 17, I did have a baby. At the age of 18, I had to get out of this marriage because this man took me through a whole new phase of alcoholism I never experienced with my mom, and it's called physical abuse. And he never abused me unless he was drinking, but he abused me to the point of cutting me up with a knife, and I had to have surgery to repair the damage. So I got out of that marriage at the age of 18. And I feel like that's when I started on the road of being everything I swore I'd never be, doing everything I swore I'd never do. And I hadn't even taken a drink of alcohol yet. I always intuitively knew if I took a drink, I'd be an alcoholic. But it started out with me being a single mother living on welfare. My whole life growing up, I swore when I grew up I wasn't going to live like that. And there I was. Now, on page 23 in the big book, it says the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. So we're talking about the main problem being the mental obsession and not the physical allergy. So I know for me, this is for me, I practiced my disease of alcoholism way before I ever took that first drink because I've always had the mental obsession part of this disease. And I practiced it in the form of compulsive overeating. I would shove food in my mouth instead of alcohol. And then I discovered that wonderful world of diet pills. And that's back in the days when doctors gave really good amphetamines. You know, methadrine, dexedrine, it's illegal today. So I went on this diet for 16 years. When I finally took that drink at the age of 25, I immediately had the physical allergy. From that very first drink, I had the phenomenon of craving. From that very first drink, I had a personality change. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, you read about that in the big book. The big book refers to that as a real alcoholic. And I personally am so physically allergic to alcohol. When I consume alcohol, I break out in a rash, welts, and hives all over my body. And I was always too drunk to have a clue that that wasn't normal. And if I'd had a clue, it wouldn't have made a difference. But from that very first drink, I drank morning, noon, and night, and I did not draw a sober breath from the age of 25 to the age of 31. And this is not an exaggeration. I had this huge spiritual experience way before I ever got to this program. And this was equivalent to the one that Bill had in Bill's story. Now, in the big book, it says, as a result of a spiritual awakening, you'll have a change in psyche, a change in attitude. It says you'll have this huge emotional displacement rearrangement. And this spiritual experience I had was not enough for me to achieve that. And I believe it's because I did not have the plan of action to go with it. But it was enough for me to come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. So what I did with this experience is I went to this church. I counseled with this minister. I told him all about my spiritual experience. I shared with him all my character defects and all my shortcomings. And this man assured me if I got really active in this church, and I read all these inspirational books, and I did all this positive thinking and all these affirmations, that I could be everything I ever wanted to be. Now, after I got to this program, I heard a speaker at the podium say, if you're alcoholic, you cannot think your way into right actions. He said, if you're alcoholic, you have to act your way into right thinking. And I am absolute proof of that, because I got really active in that church. I even became the secretary of that church, and I struggled reading those books because I could barely read. I did all that positive thinking, constant affirmations, and the only thing that resulted is I ended up having a torrid affair with this minister, and it absolutely infuriated his wife. And the rest of the congregation wasn't too excited about it either. But the one thing I'm going to share with you is the one thing I thought I would take to the grave with me. As secretary of that church, it was my job to handle the money. And when I handled that money, I stole part of that money. Now, at that point in my life, I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt my only hope was God, because I just had a spiritual experience. And I turned to God for help, and I ended up seducing his minister and ripping off his church. So I truly know the feeling of hopelessness that they talk about in the big book. And I'm going to share two stories with you while I'm on the subject of the minister. And I like to share this first story because it's the first time I was ever able to laugh at any part of my alcoholism. When I got to this program, I heard that laughter was healing. But I always thought my story was just much too serious. And when I got here, I used to hang out at the back of the room. And I have a friend named Teddy. Teddy calls the back of the room the half measure section or the denial section. Now, I didn't hang out back there for either of those reasons. I hung out back there because I couldn't read very well. And I was terrified that they would ask me to read something. And I literally could not say the word anonymity for over 6 months. So I'd always hide out to the back of the room. And in California, it's very theatrical. We have very funny speakers. And speakers would get up at the podium and share their story, and everybody would laugh, just like you were doing yesterday and last night, just howling. And at first, I was absolutely incapable of laughing. But one day, after I had some sobriety under my belt, about 2 years of sobriety under my belt, I caught myself in the back of the room laughing, too. And right after having this huge belly laugh, I found myself thinking, well, that might be funny for you, but there is nothing in my background I could ever laugh at. And then about, I lose track of time, 9 or 10 or 11 years ago, I was speaking in Seal Beach, California. It was just my second time to ever give an AA talk. I already shared with you, I didn't share my story till I was 11 years sober, so I guess it was 10 years ago. And my daughter wanted to come hear me. Now, my daughter got to this program for the first time when she was 15 years old. She managed to get 3 years of sobriety, and at the age of 18, she lost her sobriety because of that rape. So she was in and out, struggling to get sober. Today I will let you know my daughter is 36 years old, and she has 8 years of big book sobriety. And I'm very, 9 years, or she has a lot of years, 9 years. 9 years of big book sobriety, and I'm very, very thankful to you. Because of myself, I couldn't get her sober, but you did. But anyway, this was a time that she was trying to get sober near the end of her drinking, and she heard that I was speaking, and so she wanted to come hear me. The neat thing about this is I had talked a few weeks before that. It was my very first talk, and my sponsor was always encouraging me to talk. She just thought I had wonderful sobriety from where I came from to where I was. She always wanted me to speak, and I kept trying to give her that thing. It doesn't talk about being a speaker in the big book. Well, she wasn't buying that. And finally, what happened is I went in her place to this meeting because she was very ill, and so she made me go in her place. And from that meeting, I was invited to speak at 3 more meetings. But my first talk was very, very, very serious. I mean, I was so depressed when I left there. I mean, I was just, like, depressed. And I went to bed that night, and I remember telling God, okay, God, if this is what you want me to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, you're going to have to lighten up my story or I'm going to kill myself. And so the second time I talked was the night that my daughter came over with her girlfriends. She proceeded to tell all of her girlfriends my drunkalogue, and it was the first time I was ever able to laugh at anything in my alcoholism. So anything funny you might hear, from that day on to this day, my daughter gave to me that night in my second talk. So I keep it my talk. I never take it out because it made me laugh. But anyway, so we're sitting there at the dinner table, the coffee table, having coffee. She proceeds to tell all of her girls my drunk, all of those girlfriends my drunk log. They're just howling, and I started laughing. It was so funny because she was telling these girls all about the minister. And I never thought about how some of this stuff looks through the eyes of a nine-year-old. She's 9 years old when I'm seeing this minister. And so she's telling these girls, I'm dragging her off to church every day. I'm preaching at her the Ten Commandments, the Golden Rule. She comes home from school at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. She opens the bedroom door, and there, naked in bed with her mom, was the married minister of the church. Now, when she first said this, I felt all this shame, all this guilt and embarrassment. And I looked at my daughter, and I said in the most sympathetic way, I said, God, honey, that had to be a terrible shock. And she just looked at me and she said, no, Mom, I don't know what shocked me the most, seeing that minister naked or seeing his wooden leg on the floor. Up until that time, I forgot he had this artificial leg. It was a huge leg. I don't know how I forgot it. I guess it's because he was in no way disabled. I was speaking in the state of Maine, and I mean, it was big. It was like 1,000, 1,500 people. And I was a Saturday night speaker, which there it's well attended, the Saturday night. So after I talked, you know, I shared the minister one-legged story. And there's a huge line to thank me. And so everyone's thanking me, and I'm, you know, da-da-da-da-da. And all of a sudden, this man yells, Michael! And I looked over, and he took off his leg and threw it at me. I was so embarrassed in front of all these people. You know, I was just speechless. I didn't even know what to say. So finally, I just got my wits about me, and I looked at him. I went, oh, baby. Oh, God. After I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and I started working those 12 steps, I found for me the most important step was step 9. Step 9 is the amend step, the step where we make restitution. And I recommend you do the first 8 steps before you get to step 9. I know some people come into this program, they take a look at step 9, it's so scary. They turn around and they leave. Other people come in and start right in on step 9 and make very inappropriate amends. I believe the steps are in order for a reason, and I believe this one in particular should be taken with the advice of a sponsor. But I call step 9 the freedom step. This is the step that truly, truly freed me from the bondage of my past. And it's just not a coincidence that in the big book, those promises come after step 9. It says before you're halfway through, you're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. It says you won't regret the past or wish to shut the door on it, and so on and so on. And I did not have to wait to get halfway through step 9. That happened to me with my very first amends, and that was going back to that church and telling that minister I used to steal from the church funds. And he told me he knew that. And I set up a payment schedule to pay back the church. And then I had to tell him that I used to steal out of his wallet when he was in the shower. He told me he did not know that. So I made restitution to him. But the neat thing about this experience is he shared with me at that time he knew exactly what I was doing. By the time I got to him, he had 2 years of sobriety in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. When he lost his leg in that motorcycle accident, he was an alcoholic and a drug addict, and he actually died on the operating table. He had one of those near-death experiences, which for him was his spiritual experience. And that's what led him into ministerial school and becoming a minister. And even he could not get sober in church. And I'm not putting down churches. And I'm not putting down the psychiatric effort, because the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous makes it real clear that this program owes a lot to both of these institutions. And in the big book, it says, if you need professional help, do not hesitate to seek it. But I got to tell you, for me, it was all about that miracle that happens when one drunk reaches out to another drunk. So anyway, I'm 27 years old. I've been kicked out of this church. I'm full on into my drinking. I'm living in an apartment I'm being evicted from. This is my normal MO. I'm always being evicted. Lights and gas had been turned off for a long time, but I still had a telephone. It was one of my working priorities. And I got this call at 11 o'clock at night, and I could not believe the man on the other end of this phone. It was my real dad. Now, I barely knew this man's name was on my birth certificate, and he wanted to make amends for not being in my life. He wanted to get to know me, and he wanted to get to know my daughter. So he offered me an opportunity to move to Colorado to get to know his whole family. And I didn't want to go. I didn't have any desire to get to know him, but mostly I didn't want to move to the snow. But at that point in my life, I didn't have anywhere to go except for out on the streets. And deep down inside, I had this little hope, if I did this geographic, maybe I could change. So I made that move to Colorado. I lived there for 3 months, and in that three-month period, this family could not wait to kick me out of the state of Colorado. In that three-month period, I ended up having affairs with the bus drivers on the way over there, getting pregnant, having an abortion, falling down the stairs and breaking my leg, ripping off his medicine cabinet, ripping off his booze cabinet, and ripping off his money. I'm going to tell you how I broke that leg, because I think it's funny. My daughter gave it to me that night. Anyway, I lived in a second-floor apartment, and all the liquor stores closed at 12 o'clock at midnight, and so I had to make my final liquor run before the stores closed, the liquor stores closed. And it was snowing outside. The stairs are very icy from past snows. I'm walking down the stairs, hanging onto the railing with my right hand, and my daughter's on the left side of me trying to hold me up. And all of a sudden, I looked up at another second-floor apartment because the door just opened. And out of that door walked a priest. That's different from a minister. A priest wears all this stuff. He was a priest with this collar on, black robe, and a big crucifix on. He was a priest. And I looked up at that priest, and I let go of the railing with my right hand. I flipped up my middle finger, and I said, F you, God. And I immediately fell down the stairs and broke my leg. Now, my daughter tells me that is the day she started believing in a punishing God. And today, my daughter and I know we have a loving God. It had nothing to do with God. I fell because I was drunk. Anyway, my real dad was second on my list of amends to make when I started making my amends. And I wrote him this letter. And I told him that I was sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'm in California, he's in Colorado. I told him that I was sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I really wanted to make restitution for my behavior up there. And I sent him a check to set up a payment schedule to try and pay him back. And basically what he and the family did is they sent me the check back with a little note that said they didn't want my money, and they never wanted to hear from me again. I was working with a sponsor, so of course I stayed sober. But I really, really wanted to make these amends. So with my sponsor's encouragement, on every Father's Day and on every birthday, I would send him an appropriate card. And I would tell him that I was still sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I still wanted to make restitution for my behavior. And I did this for 6 or 7 years, and he would never, ever acknowledge me. And in 1985 or 1986, I finally got a reply back. And I cannot tell you how excited I was when I saw the return address on this envelope. And I ripped open the envelope, and the only thing that was in it was a picture of his tombstone and the obituary on the newspaper because he had just died. And that was the family's way of telling me not to bother trying anymore. And there are no words to express the kind of pain I felt. I took it real, real hard. You would have thought I knew him my whole life, and I didn't, but I took it real, real hard. And the people in Alcoholics Anonymous pointed out to me, I don't make amends for approval. The big book tells me I don't make amends to be forgiven. I make amends to clean up my side of the street. I make amends to stay sober. So all I can tell you is that the actions I took worked, because not once, not even once, was I ever tempted to drink over that rejection. I'm just so sorry he didn't get to know the person I am today, because I know he would have been proud. So I've been kicked out of this church. I'm kicked out of a state. I have to excuse me, I have a little polyp on my vocal cord. So I've been kicked out of this church. I've been kicked out of a state. Now I'm living back in Long Beach, California, across the street from Franklin Junior High. Now, Franklin Junior High is a gang-related school. Do you have gangs out here? Yeah? My daughter is running with a very, very dangerous gang, and I'm doing awful, humiliating, embarrassing things to her. But I'm not only embarrassing my daughter, I was embarrassing this entire gang. I was living in another apartment. I was being evicted from. Lights, gas, and telephone had all been turned off for a long time. The landlord's trying to serve me an eviction notice, so I'm always trying to hide out from him. So I kept my drapes closed so he wouldn't know I was home. So my apartment is always dark. Day and night, my apartment's dark. Now my apartment's so dark that now I'm seeing evil spirits. And unless you've seen them, they're hard to describe. But these evil spirits would do things to me, like follow me around the house. And then I, in turn, would crawl out of the house on my hands and knees, butt naked, across the street towards the school ground, and warn my daughter and her gang friends not to come home because the house was possessed with evil spirits. And this is the kind of stuff I did that makes me wish to God I was a blackout drinker. But I am not a blackout drinker. I get to remember. All the neighbors felt sorry for my daughter. They would feed her. They would hide her sometimes. Sometimes they would even feed me. Once we were next door at the neighbor's house, she was feeding both of us. And on her counter, she had a bottle of 100-proof vodka. Something happened outside, a car accident or something, and my neighbor and my daughter went to check it out. And I lagged behind because I wanted to drink some of that vodka down real fast and not get caught. I was always promising my daughter I wouldn't drink. So anyway, when they got out the door, I just grabbed that bottle. I started drinking right out of the bottle, which is my normal MO anyway. But I started drinking right out of the bottle. I don't know how much I drank or how fast I drank it, but I do know it was enough to stop my respiratory system. At that point, I stopped breathing. And I can remember the sensation I couldn't breathe. And this is the last thing I remember. I don't remember the paramedics. I don't remember being rushed to the hospital. I don't remember being brought back to life. By the time I had any memory, I woke up and both my arms are strapped down to a hospital bed. A nurse had just slapped me in the face because I was screaming obscenities at her. I was a very mean and vile drunk. But this experience did get my attention. This time I had almost died under the influence of alcohol and it scared me. I did not want to die out there. I just remember all my mom's suicide attempts and how that made me feel as a little girl. And I did not want to do that. You know, I did not want to do that to my daughter. And so it scared me. It scared me for my daughter. So I finally started listening to my daughter because my daughter used to tell me on a daily basis, she would say, Mom, it's the alcohol. And if you wouldn't drink, you wouldn't do those things. She said, just smoke pot. So this is my only experience smoking pot, but I don't have any friends of my own. So I smoked this pot with my daughter and her friends. And afterwards, we're walking down the street, and I have on these tight, tight jeans, and I have my hands stuck down in my pockets. And I don't know if I tripped over a crack or if I tripped over my own foot, but I tripped, and I just started to go down. Now, I don't know if any of you have ever been on pot, but for me, it was different. First of all, I had the feeling that I was in slow motion. I had the sensation that the cement was coming up at my face, and no matter what I did, and I tried really hard, I could not get my hands out of my pockets. So you got to picture a grown woman laying with her face smashed in cement. Her arms were still sticking out of her pockets. All the kids standing around me were laughing hysterically. They were absolutely hysterical. I guess when you smoke pot, you laugh a lot. I don't know. I wasn't laughing. I was feeling a lot. And I'm laying there in pain, and I could hear everybody laughing. And as I heard that laughter, I had that moment of clarity. Right then and there, I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that pot was not the answer. And I went right back to my drinking. And I drank at the same pace for a while longer. And what finally happened to me is I finally reached a point you read about in the Big Book on page 151. And it talks about facing the hideous four horsemen. It talks about the feelings we all have no matter how high or low our bottom is. We all have these feelings. And it wasn't the awful things I did out there that got me sober and got me to AA. It wasn't drinking till I died. It wasn't falling. It wasn't hurting my daughter. It was the feelings. You know, those hideous four horsemen, terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. I woke up on my front room floor one morning. I was laying in a puddle of fluid. I felt those feelings that I couldn't stand to feel one more day. I took the first three steps, and I didn't even know what the first three steps were. But I knew that I was powerless over alcohol and that my life had never, ever been manageable. I already believed that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I just did not think he would because of what I'd done to the church. And this was my way of turning my will and my life over to the care of God as I just got on my knees. And I said, God, please, I don't care how you do it, but please just get me sober. And I managed to get to a telephone. I called a prayer line that was affiliated with the church I used to be in. And I asked them to pray for me. Because in my mind, I thought if God would not listen to my prayers because of what I'd done to the church, maybe God would listen to their prayers. And they prayed for me for 30 days. And within 30 days, I was sober. And it's a series of God coincidences that landed me in my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I would never have come to AA. It's a good thing I told God I didn't care how he did it, because this is the last place I would have come, because my mom was in and out of AA for years, and she proved to me it didn't work. Today I know my mom did not work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. She would never do the steps or get a sponsor. But I didn't know that then. I know it today. But the real reason why I didn't want to come here is because my mom hung around with some really sleazy AA men. Do you know what sleazy means? Really sleazy AA men. And there's not only sleazy AA men, there's sleazy AA women. You know, there's people in these rooms that are just taking up space. Not at a convention. Usually people who come to conventions are very serious about the program. But people in just the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, some of them are just taking up space. The heat's on, and so they're just trying to get the heat off. They don't care about the 12 steps. They don't care about the 12 traditions. They don't care about your anonymity. That's why I don't share my stuff in a meeting. I carry the message in a meeting and a mess to my sponsor. These are the kind of people my mom hung out with. And two of these men, I was a very young girl, 12 or 13 years old, two of these men made very serious passes at me. And so that's what I thought about the men in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think our actions out there in the world are very important because we might be the only copy of a big book somebody ever reads. Anyway, it was a series of coincidences that got me in my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was so physically sick from withdrawals, there's no way I would have made that meeting without a drink. And I ended up having two beers before the meeting. That's the last drink I ever had, and that was on November 10th, 1979. However, I don't celebrate my birthday till 3 months later, because I continue to do those diet pills for the reasons that Mickey explained last night, is that we didn't talk about drugs in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I continue to do those diet pills. But when I quit drinking, I started working my steps. And God revealed to me I was not sober if I was abusing those pills. So I gave those up January 23rd, 1980, and that's when I celebrate my birthday. So anyway, I'm supposed to share with you what it was like, what happened to change me, and what I'm like today. What happened to change me were the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and what keeps me here are the 12 traditions and the 12 concepts. And I used to talk about the each step and how I did it, but it makes you talk too long as you add stuff like menopause. So I'm not going to do that. But I want you to know what I looked like when I got here. First of all, I was huge. I was very, very obese. And if I don't do something quick, I'm going to be there again. No, I'm doing my best right now. Okay. I was very, very obese. I had all this wild, wild bleach blonde hair. Have you ever been drunk and tried to bleach your hair? Do you guys know what bleaching is? Well, you do this thing called overlapping, and it causes your hair to break off. And then I'd fall asleep with bleach on my hair, and so I'd have it spread, and I'd have a few bald spots. And then the last couple months, I didn't care, so I didn't try and bleach it at all. So I had big black roots, a few bald spots, and broken off bleach blonde hair. My front teeth were worn up to the gum line, so it looked like I had no front teeth. And I was an alcoholic woman that was profusely sweating. I did not bathe. And I wore this big purple serape to cover my body in hopes that you wouldn't see me. And that's what came to you 21 years ago, November 10th, 1979. And I'm so thankful for the men in Alcoholics Anonymous at my home group. They were the father images that I never had. They were like my husband is to the people in our home group and to the women I sponsor. They were dignified. They were respectful. They treated me with dignity. And they treated me like they were a loving father. And I'm so very thankful. I did have a female sponsor, but it was the men in Alcoholics Anonymous who really made a difference in my life and got me sober at that time. And they were taking me to places I had no business going. They immediately gave me a coffee commitment. My first 2 weeks, they gave me a coffee commitment. How would you like that, making your coffee at a meeting? Scary, huh? And they took me to detoxes, hospitals, sanitariums, and prisons on a panel. And I just sit there and wonder, what are they taking me to these places for? I have never even been in prisons. I've never been locked up in a sanitarium. And what I know they were doing is they were teaching me the yets out there. They were teaching me I haven't done it yet. I haven't done it yet, but if I keep drinking, those were the places I was going to end up. And it took me a long time to realize what their motive was behind that. I'm just so very, very thankful. Anyway, I was 6 months sober, and I was on my ninth step. My sponsor told me I had to get a job. I had to be fully self-supporting through my own contributions, and I don't know how to work. I went out there, and I got my first job, and that's where I learned how to work. I learned things like how to get there every day, how to get there on time, how to only take a 30-minute lunch break, not leave early. I did not know how to do those things. I learned them here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I worked my first year full-time, my first job full-time for 8 years. And I stayed there another 2 years part-time after I took another full-time position. So I was there for a total of 10 years. And when I left that job, I'd worked myself up to assistant administrator. And in that first 8-year period, I went back to high school. I was not smart enough to pass a GED. I had to go back to high school. And I graduated from high school in 1985, and I was 36 years old. And I graduated with a cap, a gown, a real ceremony, and 450 18-year-olds. Truly a humbling experience. What I did for the next 6 years is I went to work for Musical Theater Corporation, and it was equity, and equity means union, which means that they dealt with big, big major stars. And I started out in the very bottom in the accounting department, and I went back to school. I went back to college. And within a period of time, I worked myself up to business manager of this multi-million dollar corporation. And as business manager, I dealt with millions of dollars. And this is the honest to God truth. When I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not know how many zeros were in $1 million. I have participated in union negotiations, and I have been invited into some of the homes of some of the most famous people you see on stage, screen, and TV. And even today, I'll see myself in a picture with a very famous person. And I just get overwhelmed, and I just think, how did I ever get from the gutters of Long Beach to being invited into some of these places? And how that happened is I worked the last part of that 12th step, and I applied these principles in all my affairs. I'm going to share one last story with you, and then I'm going to close. And it's how I came to terms with the God I have in my life today. I told you that my daughter was 15 years old when she got sober. She was 18 years old. She had 3 years of sobriety. She and her daughter were leaving an AA dance. She and a girlfriend were leaving an AA dance. They were in the parking lot of the dance. A man came up to him with a gun, forced these two girls in the car at gunpoint, and he kidnapped them. He knocked the one girl totally unconscious and brutally raped my daughter for over 2 hours. And I absolutely hate the word rape, because rape sounds like it's just about sex. But rape is really about terror, and it's about violence. And my daughter was so angry at God, it took her over 2 years to remember. She did say a quiet prayer to live. This man was drinking. He had a bottle of alcohol in his pocket that he drank throughout the whole ordeal. So thank God he got quite drunk. And at the point where he was trying to force my daughter into the trunk of the car, because she knew he was going to kill her, he was forcing my daughter into the trunk of the car. Somehow my daughter got the courage to at least make some kind of an effort to try to save her own life. And she caught him off guard. She slugged him in the face as hard as she could. He tripped and he fell down. The gun slid under the wheel. She ran down the street naked, and she got away. He later got into the car and took off with the car, but somewhere he rolled the other girl out into the street. So both girls lived. But the road of recovery was real hard, and it was real long. My daughter and I felt absolutely betrayed. You know, I had some man come up to me and say, why do you talk about it like it happened to you, it happened to your daughter? Obviously, he's not a mother. You know, obviously, he wasn't up every night with her for 2 years having nightmares. You know, I mean, it affects you when it's your child. And my daughter and I felt absolutely betrayed by God. How could God let this happen to us? We were both sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. How could God let this happen to us? We were working these steps as hard as we could, and this is a spiritual program. But the hardest thing for me to deal with was a sentence in the big book, in the English book, not in your book. And it's page 449, and it quotes a sentence that's very famous in the United States. And that sentence says, absolutely nothing in God's world happens by mistake. Clancy says, alcoholism is a disease of perception. I'm still an alcoholic. I still get my disease of perception because I perceive that to mean that if nothing in God's world happens by mistake, then that had to be an act of God. It had to be an act of God. And I wanted to leave Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wanted to leave God because I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt I did not want any part of a God that could operate like that. And thank God for this old timer named Bill Honeycutt. He just took me by the hand and he said, Michael, God is good and good is God. And if it's not good, it's not of God. He said, man has free will. That man was acting on his free will and your daughter was just a victim. He said, if man didn't have free will, we wouldn't all be sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. We'd all be perfect people. And when he told me that, I had a spiritual release. I knew he was telling me the truth. And I love to hear my sponsor, Polly, share. She always talks about finding God deep within. And that's what it says in the big book. It says we find God deep within. And on that same page, it says it may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things. And when I'm into calamity and I'm into fear, even today, I feel disconnected from my higher power. And that's when I desperately, desperately need the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because if God is deep within me, God is deep within you. And it's at these times that God will reach out through another member of this program and pull me back into the sunlight of the Spirit. And that's what happened to me through a man named Bill Honeycutt. So I came to terms with my God again. But I still had so much trouble with that sentence in the Big Book. I could see, hear somebody quote it, see it on a license plate, and I would just feel absolute rage. And I sponsor a lot of women in this program, and because I have the story I have, I sponsor women who have suffered terrible, terrible tragedies. And one of these women, whose tragedy was worse than my daughter's, made the mistake of telling me that her tragedy must be God's will, because in the Big Book it says absolutely nothing in God's world happens by mistake. This woman desperately needed comfort. And I went off on her like a crazy woman, and I started screaming at her to the top of my lungs that that was not written by the first 100 alcoholics. It's not in the first 164 pages of the Big Book. I slammed the Big Book down. I said, that's not even in the first two editions of this book. And I made this woman cry. And I knew at that point I was the one who had a problem. I have a resentment about something in the Big Book. But this resentment's not only hurting me. Now this resentment is hurting other people. And because it was hurting other people, I came to a place of really being willing to give it up. And I prayed for a very long time for God to just help me with that sentence. And about 7 or 8 years ago, I was already getting on airplanes and sharing my story, but I didn't have this ending. About 7 years ago, I was with my sponsor, Polly, in a meeting. And she was sharing about that tape out by Clancy. And the name of the tape is Alcoholism, Disease of Perception. You know, how our perception and the way we see things are distorted. And right in that meeting, when she said the words, disease of perception, I had the biggest spiritual encounter that I have ever had. And I couldn't hear another word Polly said. I couldn't see anything else in the room. Everything was like a big white light. And I had an inner voice talk to me, and it was loud, it was clear, and it wasn't through the ears. And it said, Michael, you know what happens in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is part of God's world. What happens when you're working those 12 steps is part of God's world. The progression of all good is part of God's world. What happened in that car 9 years ago was part of man's world. So at that point, I came to a place of being able to separate man's world from God's world. And I can tell you today, absolutely nothing in God's world happens by mistake. It's God's world that got me to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. 2 weeks after I had that spiritual experience, through a real weird series of coincidences, those God coincidences, I found myself sitting down at a dinner table right next to Dr. Paul, who wrote that sentence in the Big Book. And I was at such peace, I did not have to go off on this man and tell him all about my resentment. Because at that point, I knew it did not matter what he meant when he wrote it. What mattered was how I perceived it, how I looked at it. And sometimes I have to work on my perception so that perception can work in my life. And that might not work for you, and that's okay, because I truly believe that God works for each one of us at our own level of understanding. I once heard, if you take one step towards God, God takes 10 steps towards you. And in this lifetime, as we know it, we will never, ever reach God's level of understanding. But once we're on a spiritual path, God does not want to lose one of us. So he comes to each one of us. He works for each one of us at our individual level of understanding. And that's why what works for you might not work for me. What works for me might not work for you. But the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous is whatever you believe, it will work within the 12 steps. Since that day that man's heard my talk, we've had lots of spiritual talks. We've talked at lots of conventions together. We lost Dr. Paul a year ago, May 19th, and I'm very saddened by that, but I still feel his spirit when I talk. And what he told me about that sentence is he did not mean anything like that when he wrote that sentence. He told me he was not thinking of man's inhumanity to man. He said my spiritual experience was the best explanation he could think of as to why evil exists in this world. And I'm so thankful I paid attention to something I read in the 12 and 12 under step 10. It said restraint of pen and tongue. Because when I found out this man was still alive, I used to think everybody in the Big Book was dead. When I found out this man was still alive, I cannot tell you how many countless times I sat down and I started to write him a hate letter and tell him exactly what I thought about him and exactly what I thought about that sentence. And if I'd followed through on it, I would have missed out on this gift, because he became a gift in my life. And he would get lots of letters about that sentence, and he would get lots of phone calls about that sentence from people who had tragedies. And what he would do is just give him my phone number. I really want to thank you for allowing me to be here. I know today I have been catapulted into what Bill calls the fourth dimension of existence. And he talks about it in two places in the big book, in the English big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The most quoted page is page 25, and it says rocketed into that fourth dimension. But my favorite page is page 8, where he says catapulted, because on that page, he gives you a description of what that fourth dimension is like. And I can tell you today, in that fourth dimension, I know happiness, I know peace, but best of all, absolutely best of all today, I know usefulness. Thank you.